a production of South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
She's willing, she's able, she's committed to remain serving on this commission and making a difference in the lives of the people that we serve. So with that, I would ask for your support in her reappointment. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further remarks on Dr. Martz? Seeing none, the chair will entertain a motion of advice and consent on the reappointment of Teresa Martz. We have a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
We have a motion and second, advice and consent of Teresa Martz to the South Dakota Crime Victims Compensation Commission. Any comments? Seeing none, those in favor say aye. Those opposed, nay. The secretary will take the roll.
Senators Gillespie, Heideprim, Schmidt,
aye.
Trivette Berry,
aye.
Valley,
aye.
Teason,
aye.
Abdallah,
aye. That'll go to the floor. Senate Bill 43 that's proposed by the committee by the Public Utilities Commission will be deferred until Tuesday, January 26th, at their request. That brings us to Senate Bill 44, authorize the Public Utilities Commission to conduct certain rulemaking proceedings by teleconference.
Good morning. My name is Relaine Wiest. I'm an attorney with the Public Utilities Commission. Senate Bill 44, this bill would allow any person interested in PUC rulemaking to actually provide comments over the phone. The change can be found on page 2, line 6, and that's where we exempt the PUC from the current prohibition against having teleconference calls for hearings or taking final disposition in rulemaking hearings. We believe that with this change, that it will allow for increased participation at our rulemaking hearings. Currently, if a person wishes to provide comments, the person must either show up in person or provide written comments. And I would also note that for each of our dockets, including our rulemaking dockets, they are all posted. All of the written comments and anything that's filed with the docket is posted on our website for easy access. And with that, we would ask for your support. Thank you.
Any questions of the committee? Senator Heideprim.
Ms. Wiest, could you just tell me how this would change rulemaking from the commission's point? I understand what you're saying about an interested individual who could now phone in. Is this going to change at all the way in which the commission makes decisions? Will there still be a meeting? Will there still be the traditional access to cases? This is designed to change the current public meeting.
Mr. Chairman? No, not at all. This actually just provides for increased participation. And the reason for the increased participation would mean that somebody at our rulemaking hearing, which of course is open to the public, would actually be able to join by telephone. And for example, in a recent interconnection docket, which was very technical, the utilities had a number of experts that were from out of town, and they weren't able to join the hearing, and this would have allowed them to actually join the hearing by phone.
If I could follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
Ms. Wiest, the reason I was concerned is because it says on page 2, line 6, and for proceedings conducted by the PUC. Now, that suggests to me that it's more inclusive than just empowering someone to phone in, but maybe I'm not, maybe I'm seeing things where there aren't any.
Mr. Chairman, the intent, of course, was that, you know, except for the Digital Dakota Network and for our proceedings, it would just exempt us from that last sentence that says they can't do it by teleconference. We only want to be exempt from the prohibition against providing telephone access during our rulemaking hearings.
Mr. Chairman, and maybe I'm wrong about this, but it says to me that you could now conduct hearings by teleconference. Am I wrong about that?
We would be able to allow participation by teleconference. That is true. But even if we have a teleconference, we would still have an actual hearing where the commissioners would be and show up. It was just during that.
I'm the only one who sees that. It says to me that you can now, if we pass this, the prohibition about just having teleconferences and conducting hearings is removed, so that you could then conduct hearings via teleconference.
Mr. Chairman, it would allow for someone to join a hearing by teleconference, a rulemaking hearing by teleconference. That is correct. But it would also, we would still continue with our practice, and that would be that we would have an actual, you know, we usually meet in the Capitol here, and there would be a place for people to either show up or join by teleconference.
Mr. Chair.
Right, if I may have a follow-up. Senator Valley.
Go ahead.
It appears to me, and frankly, I find this whole, the existing section even somewhat confusing, but that's probably just due to my unfamiliarity with it. But it appears to me that under existing law, clearly meetings can be conducted by teleconference, but that hearings may not. Apparently, there's an anticipated distinction between meetings and hearings. Is that correct?
The way we read the statute is no teleconference may be used in conducting, and that would be rulemaking hearings, because they say pursuant to 126.4, which is the rulemaking statute, which refers to hearings and final disposition, and that's when the commissioners take their final vote.
Right. But obviously, and I don't know if there are there must be meetings other than such hearings, are there not?
I believe generally that they're referenced as a hearing where the any interested person can show up at the rulemaking hearing.
I'm not doing any better than Senator Heideprim was at getting these ships to quit passing in the night. I understand that your purpose is to allow witnesses, citizens to call in. But certainly under the language as it changes, it appears that you could in theory have a hearing where everyone was participating by teleconference, couldn't you?
Mr. Chairman, the commission would still have an actual place where people could show up, though. But yes,
my question is not what you think they would do. My question is what would be allowed under the law.
Yes, someone who wanted to speak could do so by teleconference. That's
and if the commission decided to, they could all stay in their homes and participate by teleconference, could they not?
That is probably possible.
I mean, I think that, is that what you were getting at, Senator Heideprim? And address for us, if you will, whether that's a good thing, a bad thing, or something, I mean, something we should be concerned about or not.
I think that when we talked about, you know, when we talked about changing this statute, the whole purpose, of course, was to allow someone to, you know, join by teleconference, but that the commissioners would be present and be at the meeting or the hearing. It wouldn't be the intent of the commissioners to join by teleconference. Yeah. But I understand your point.
Mr. Chair, I hate to, this is the very first bill I've participate in hearing on this legislative session, and I hate to be the first one to start derailing things right out of the chute. But I'm wondering if we aren't I wonder if we aren't doing a less than ideal job at fixing the problem. It makes perfect sense to me that not only the PUC, but other entities might want to invite testimony by teleconference. But I'm not sure that we want to. So we may want it more general in that regard. At the same time, I don't think that we necessarily want to make the decision that the whatever commissioner board may be conducting the hearing itself can participate by teleconference. Is that what your questions are getting
at?
Please.
What the chair would entertain deferring this to another date if you would like to clarify your bill.
Certainly. We would appreciate it having been deferred, and we can clear up that. And your point is that you would want to make it clear that the commissioners would be present.
Senator Heideprin.
If I could, Ms. Weiss, I think it's a – I don't know that anyone is opposed to the principle that you started with, which is that people should be as accessible as possible for these meetings. But I think that's a simple one-sentence change which we could make, and I'm sure that many of us would be happy to work with you in doing that.
Okay.
We'll defer it until Tuesday, the 26th of January, and we'll schedule it again then.
Okay, thank you.
Senate Bill 54, the request of the Department of Corrections to revise certain procedures for the commencement of civil actions by inmates. Is Lori here? She is.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Lori Filer with the Department of Corrections. As the committee chair indicated, this is an agency bill brought at the request of the Department of Corrections. The title is An Act to Revise Certain Procedures for the Commencement of Civil Actions by Inmates. This bill really mirrors some of the basic provisions of the Federal Prison Litigation Reform Act and deals with civil actions in state court. It's really just a small step in an attempt to clarify and streamline the processes for inmates seeking to pursue civil actions in state court. We also hope that it minimizes some of the opportunities for inmate abuse of the state court system. This bill applies to prisoners in both state and local custody, and it requires prisoners to exhaust their administrative remedies before they take action in state court. We really think that we should have the first whack at trying to resolve whatever the issue is, and that's the notion of requiring that they exhaust administrative remedies before they take it into court. This bill also disallows civil action solely for mental or emotional anguish. It has to be tied to an actual physical damage or physical injury. By nature, incarceration does cause the normal person some emotional or mental discomfort and angst. Finally, this bill makes it clear that the court can dismiss an action with respect to prison conditions if the court determines that the action is frivolous, malicious, fails to state a claim upon which relief can be granted, or seeks relief from a defendant who's immune from such relief. This bill does not apply to administrative appeals, 126 appeals, or to extraordinary writs, including the habeas. The last section of the bill makes it clear that it does not apply to the habeas corpus. Generally, there's between 20 and 30 active inmate lawsuits at any given time for DOC. And in most cases, in almost all cases, the inmate does not prevail. So this is just one little step dealing with just state court actions that the DOC would like the committee to consider. I will try to handle any questions the committee has. Also in the room is the department's attorney, Max Gores, and Max and I will probably work together on any questions. Thank you.
Any questions of the committee for Ms. Filer?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Turbeck-Berry.
I guess, first of all, I appreciate the purpose and support that. I think there is a direct correlation between, for all of us, it seems like, between the goods and services we consume and the cost of doing so. And sometimes when there isn't much cost, we overconsume things. And I think probably the use of the courts in this venue is one instance of that. My first question is whether the intent of this bill is to deal only with civil actions that would be actions against the public entity. In other words, basically prisoner rights type actions. Is that the intent?
Yes.
I'm not finding any place in the bill where it's limited to that. Can you point me in that direction? Because it certainly is possible that prisoners would have other rights to civil actions that would be wholly independent of their status as prisoner, whether that's some injury they sustained before they were incarcerated or some family court matter or whatever. But I don't see anything at all that limits the reach of this bill to just those actions that where the state or a subdivision is the defendant.
Mr. Chairman, Section 4 partially addresses the issue, Senator, and it's just partially. I'll acknowledge that. It's injury suffered in custody, very last line in Section 4, or page 1, very last line on page 1.
Well, that isn't limiting the bill. That's a whole different hurdle that we can talk about in a moment. But I guess, am I right then in saying that the bill is maybe drafted more broadly than what your intent is? Because it looks to me like you could be sitting in the county jail under arrest, and all of a sudden, your rights with regard to any civil action you would bring against anybody for any purpose now funnel through this procedure and restriction, I believe. True as far as you can tell?
Mr. Chairman, again, there's a couple of sections where I would say that it does specifically narrow it down to things that happen while the person is in custody, but I also understand what Senator Turbock-Berry is saying in terms of a more global application of it.
My second question is actually about Section 4. And I guess I've got a couple questions about that. My understanding of the law of personal injury is that, but I may be wrong on this, but my understanding is that in South Dakota generally, recovery for mental and emotional injuries have to be accompanied by a physical manifestation of injury. Senator Heiderprim's chuckling. Have I forgotten my tort law, Senator?
Oh, unfortunately, I'm responsible for that rule, but that is true.
All right. That in any case, whether this has anything to do with the prisoners or whether it's someone suing me because I some private conduct I engaged in, that we already have a rule in law, I believe, that requires physical injury before someone can recover from mental and emotional injury. So my question with regard to Section 4 is really twofold. One is, why is it even necessary? And my second question is, what kind of prior showing, what would be the procedure for making the prior showing that would have to be brought before they're allowed to start a lawsuit? To whom would they make the showing, and how would they do it?
Mr. Chairman, if I may, could I defer to Max
sure.
Gores? Thank you.
Mr. Gores?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Max Gores. I'm a Special Assistant Attorney General, and I work for the Department of Corrections, and I'm a registered public lobbyist. The kind of thing that we're talking about here, an inmate sued the institution for millions of dollars because we wouldn't let him have a satanic Bible. Another inmate sued the jail in Winter and the Department of Corrections because 3 years ago when he was in jail in Winter, they wouldn't let him smoke. Now, these are claims for damages without a physical injury. And we're trying to deal with that problem.
Mr. Chair, I understand and I support and sympathize with you, but I think that under existing law, in both the instances you described, they already lose under existing law. So my question is, one, why do you need another rule when it's already the rule? And second, how would you make a prior showing? In what venue, to whom, and by what standards?
This act would streamline the process for moving to dismiss lawsuits like this and make it clear that for a prison inmate, that the rule that you're talking about, physical injury, would apply. That's not perfectly clear now.
Well, with all due respect, nor is your answer to me. I'm not under. Do they make the prior showing to the circuit court judge? Do they make it to someone else? How does this work?
What would happen is if the prior showing is not made when the filing is made, I would move
to whom?
Dismiss.
To whom?
It has to be in the pleadings.
They make a showing in the pleadings.
Well, the showing is an allegation, part of the complaint. If you make a complaint that you didn't get the Satanic Bible, you haven't met this law, because there's no showing that it's related to a physical injury and it would be subject to being dismissed.
Okay, my last question, if I may, is, isn't it already the law that South Dakota Circuit Court judges have the authority to dismiss frivolous lawsuits?
I believe they do.
Thank you.
Further questions? Senator Hedeprin.
Do I hear you then, Judge, that we should maybe strike prior showing and insert the word claim? Would that carry out what you really intend, claim of physical injury?
That works for me.
And the Satanic Bible thing, I can't imagine that would survive more than 10 minutes in front of any circuit judge in South Dakota. Am I wrong about that? I mean, that to me is as frivolous a claim as I can imagine.
The problem with all of these is that we have to go in and do the litigation. I brought an example of a frequent flyer, and I also brought an example of one inmate who has filed enormous amounts of paper, and I'm now only after 3 years getting to the point where it's going to be, I think I've won the case. Mr. Chairman, if I may.
Go ahead.
What's this to?
Sure. The page will pass them for you.
If I may, Senator.
Go ahead.
This box represents the litigation with one inmate that has carried on for 3 years. There's more of it back in my office. But every time that I file something and get it down to where it looks like I'm going to get it done, this inmate files something else somewhere else. He has sued the governor, the chief justice, Judge Severson, the clerk of courts in Minnehaha County, me, the members of the Board of Pardons and Paroles, most of the staff of parole services, the warden of the penitentiary, and everybody you can imagine. He has also brought a habeas action in North Dakota, which was immediately transferred to South Dakota, but I had to go get that done. He's filed a half a dozen habeases in South Dakota. He's filed numerous civil actions and has filed administrative appeals. This has been bottomless. It has consumed an enormous amount of time, and as you can see, we've killed an enormous number of trees. And we're trying to get some of this stopped. I passed out for you, and I will tell you at the beginning that this particular inmate, Thomas Pellegrino, most of these are federal lawsuits. But this is an example of a frequent flyer. Mr. Pellegrino refuses medical treatment and then sues us for not giving him medical treatment. There are 23 actions listed here by Judge Bastian in a case out in, must be in Belfouche, or it's up in Lawrence County, up in Deadwood. But Judge Bastian was frustrated with this inmate and he listed all of them in here. These are the kinds of abuses of the court system and your taxpayer dollars when I have to spend the kind of time, the kind of paper, and the kind of effort to deal with basically nothing, with a ridiculous lawsuit that amounts to a man who says, I won't take the treatment, but you have to treat me. So those are the examples, and that's what we're trying to deal with.
Senator Teason.
Thank you. Well, first of all, I suggested a solution for these kinds of cases when I was police chief, but I got in trouble for it, so I won't suggest it to you as an option. But I guess my simple question to you is, so are you convinced that the legislation being proposed will solve or help solve that perennial problem?
It will help. We can't solve it entirely, but if we can stop it sooner, that helps.
Further questions of the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Terbeckberry.
And I know I want to help, and I suspect Senator Heideprim does as well. You need not worry about convincing us of the need. I agree with that. My concern is, do we really move the ball forward? Would we not... Is the heart of what you want to do to have an administrative remedy precondition? If we could hone in on getting the bill cleaned up so that the real issue was it gives you one more defense to raise on a summary judgment motion, namely that administrative remedies were not exhausted. Is that really kind of the heart of what we're talking about here?
That's one of the things. I will say, Senator, I did not draft this bill. I would have drafted it a little more case-specific and, frankly, have some suggestions if you want us to make them by way of amendments to come back another time.
I certainly would welcome that.
Is that what you would like to do?
I think that would be a good thing. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So you want me to defer this one, too, for a while?
Please.
We're rolling right along here. All right, we'll put this one up for the 26th. We'll defer it till the 26th Tuesday.
Thank you.
What about Senate Bill 55, Lori?
I'm going to take a run at that.
Now?
Yep.
Okay. Senate Bill 55 to revise certain provisions regarding parole eligibility.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Lori Filer again with the Department of Corrections. Senate Bill 55 is also a Department of Corrections bill. This deals with a couple of very specific scenarios regarding the calculation of parole dates. And I've asked the pages to hand out examples of this. I think this will help me explain it. At least I hope it will. These are not scenarios that impact very many inmates at all. They need to be addressed because they do impact a couple, but they're very, very specific scenarios. The first in Section 1 deals with the issue of inmates who have what we call split sentences. It's not terribly uncommon for an inmate to be sentenced to, let's say, 15 years with 10 years suspended. And what happens then is that person then goes to prison for their 5 years and has a parole date figured on that 5-year sentence. They may go out on parole, and then at some point they move to suspended sentence, but they remain under the supervision of the Board of Pardons and Paroles. Once they're committed to the executive branch, they're under the supervision of the Board of Pardons and Paroles. Well, the statute that we're seeking to amend in Section 1, which is 24-15A-29, requires that if a person violates their parole, has their parole revoked, comes back in, that the parole board needs to set a discretionary parole hearing within 24 months of that revocation, except if they commit a new crime. You know, sometimes if they commit a new crime in the community, they're going to have a parole date that's longer longer out than that 2 years. The part that's not in the statute that we're seeking to clarify is if the board also imposes that suspended sentence. And if you could look at the example on the sheet that the page handed out under the Section 1 example, I'll try to kind of walk the committee through this. In this example, let's say the person does have a 15-year sentence with 10 years suspended. Just for pretend purposes, I said this is a Class 3 violent offender, so it would be like an aggravated assault. And let's say that this person has a second-time felon, which means that they have to do 60% of their prison time before parole. So when they first came in, the orange and yellow piece of it is the incarceration period. A 15-year sentence with 10 years suspended results in 5 years in prison. So the darker yellow is the first 3 years, that's when they're in prison. And then at 60% of that 5 years, they would be parole eligible. So their parole date would be at the end of those 3 years. If they did what they were supposed to, they'd go out on parole for years 4 and 5. And then they would move to suspended sentence for years 6 through 15. That's how things would go if they went the way they were supposed to. Let's say the same scenario, but this guy at year 6, right after he goes to a suspended sentence, he has a big enough problem that they end up pulling him back in. The board looks at him, revokes his suspended sentence, and imposes the 15-year sentence. Then we have to go back and refigure that parole date. Well, on a 15-year sentence, 60% of that is 9 years to parole. So this fellow now would not even have a date on that imposed sentence, that 15-year sentence, until 9 years. But if he came back at 6 years, if we try to apply that 24 months, he'd be looking for a parole hearing at about year 8, even though he's not even eligible. And so what we're trying to do in Section 1 is address that issue, to say if you have a suspended sentence that's imposed and that parole date is farther out than 24 months, that you don't have to be seen for a discretionary hearing, because there's no reason to see him. We can't parole him again because he hasn't hit that date. There's 5 guys in the system that this applies to, so it's a very specific set of circumstances, and it's just a clarification. The second piece of the bill also deals with a parole calculation, and this seeks to amend 2415A16.1. 2 years ago, this legislature passed a bill that indicated if there's a suspended imposition of sentence, that a person has a suspended imp, and they go on to commit a subsequent felony, that suspended imp, whether it's revoked or not, that will be charged as their first felony for purposes of parole. Again, if a person has 2 felonies or 3 felonies, they have to do a higher percentage to time for parole. That's why it matters. When we were working on that bill, we made it very clear that the date the person is first put on the suspended imposition of sentence is the date of offense, or the date that the date of conviction for purposes of figuring out, is this the first felony or the second felony? What's since happened is as we've looked at that, if we look at the literal reading of that law right now, it might imply that we actually have to start the parole date calculation if that person were to violate that suspended imp. Start that parole date calculation way back at the time they were first put on the suspended imp. Again, looking at my example, let's just say, for instance, August 1 of 2008, a person, let's say I get a suspended imposition for a felony DUI, DUI third. And a suspended imp is usually, you know, first-time offender, give you a break, it's not going to go on your record. Okay, let's say I get a suspended imp for that. Then a year later, I get another DUI, get picked up for a DUI fourth. And at that point, the judge convicts me of it and sends me to prison for a DUI fourth. Then a month later, the court comes back and says, and by the way, we're also going to revoke your suspended imp on your DUI third and send you to prison on that one, too. And that is not that uncommon that it happens in that order, that you get convicted of the new offense first, and then they'll come back and revoke that suspended imp. In this particular scenario, the DWI third is the first felony conviction, because we look at when was that person first put on that suspended imp, and that was August 1 of 2008. And the DUI fourth is the second conviction. However, if I'm not sentenced to prison until September 1, 2009 for that DUI third, my time does not start way back in August of 2008 on that. It starts when the judge sentenced me. Now, the judge can give me jail time credit if I had to do some jail time as part of that suspended imp. But that's what we're trying to get to with this. Again, There haven't been any situations where we've actually had an inmate successfully say, yeah, you need to do my dates this way. But when we realized the law was not as clear as it should be and had to change this other Section 1, we decided to try to address this as well. So,
any questions, Ms. Feiler? Senator Teason?
Well, I'm not sure if I have a question or not. I think you, it's the second explanation I've listened to, and I think I've got it. But Section 1 is merely taking away the possibility that we would be required to have a parole hearing for somebody that's not parole eligible. Correct?
Yes, for the when they have an imposed suspended sentence, yes.
Which yes. Seems nonsensical that we would do that. And the second situation seems to fall into the category of no good deed goes unpunished because it's that suspended imp, that first suspended imp that's causing the problem here if we have to revert back to that for our calculation. Am I on the right track?
We want to figure the parole date based on when they're actually sentenced to prison rather than months or maybe even years when they were originally put on that suspended imp.
Okay, I think I've got it. Thank you, sir.
Other questions? Thank you. Are there other proponents of Senate Bill 55? Proponents of Senate Bill 55. Seeing none. Are there opponents of Senate Bill 55? Opponents. The public hearing on Senate Bill 55 is closed for committee discussion and or action. Senator Heideprim moves to pass, second by Senator Teason. Any further discussion? Seeing none, those in favor of Senate Bill 55 signify by saying aye. Those opposed, nay. Secretary will take the roll.
Senators Heideprim?
Aye.
Schmidt?
Aye.
Turbeck-Berry?
Aye.
Valley?
Aye.
Teason?
Aye.
Abdallah?
Aye. 6-0. That takes care of the calendar for today. Is there any further business of the committee? We will have another committee meeting on Thursday, the 21st. I'm not clear on the time yet. Probably, how many? Those 6 minute ones. 8 o'clock, Thursday, the 21st. We're going to try and take all the sex offender registry bills up, and we have, I believe, 8 of them. So we should get started on them as soon as we can, 8 o'clock. If there's no further business, the chair will entertain a motion to adjourn.
Second.
We have a motion, second to adjourn. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
We're adjourned.